Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on Egypt now, with the generals back in charge 3 years after the revolution, and the Supreme Commander Field Marshal Sisi having just been given the army's approval to run for president. Ambassador Cynthia Snyder, former U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands, now professor of diplomacy at Georgetown University, joins us to discuss her article at CNN, How America Abandoned Egypt's Arab Spring, and whether the presidential election in April will mark the end of Egypt's flirtation with democracy. Then, with President Obama expected to discuss income and wealth disparity in his upcoming State of the Union address, we will speak with Sam Pizzagatti, whose latest book is The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class. He joins us to discuss his latest article at the Washington Spectator, Plutocrats Ponder in the Alps, and the likelihood of Obama taking the Congress to task for enacting the agenda of the plutocrats at the expense of a viable middle class and living wages for working Americans. Then finally, in advance of the State of the Union, we will discuss what kind of house the president is addressing, given that half of the room appear to have made a career out of demonizing Obama in ways that are both racist and disrespectful to the office of the presidency. Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, joins us to talk about his new book, Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class, and whether or not Obama will call out his tormentors in Congress who use race to unite and motivate their dwindling base. And joining us now is Ambassador Cynthia Snyder, who is a professor of diplomacy at Georgetown University, dean of the School of Diplomacy at Dubrovnik International University, and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. From 1998 to 2001, she served as U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands, during which time she led initiatives in cultural diplomacy, biotechnology, cybersecurity, and education. She has an article at CNN, How America Abandoned Egypt's Arab Spring. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cynthia Snyder.
Thank you very much for having me.
And on Saturday, Field Marshal Sisi in Egypt held a big rally to gauge public demand for him running for president. And now apparently he's decided that the Egyptian people really want him to run for president, and it's likely to be announced in the next couple of days. And contrasting to that, of course, is the former president who was ousted by General Sisi is on trial for a jailbreak, and he's sort of screaming at the judge, saying, "Who are you? I'm the president of Egypt, and who are you?" So there's some odd theater going on in Egypt, and I think it's for those who saw the hope of democracy 3 years ago, it's not a pretty picture.
Well, I think, Ian, your choice of the word theater is a very good one, because that's what a lot of this is, certainly in the case of the quote-unquote support for, I guess we have to call him now, Field General Sisi. You know, the support for him that came out in Tahrir Square was also quite a bit like the quote-unquote support for the Constitution, namely that only those who already supported him had their voices heard. You know, it was quite a restricted thing in the square. You were allowed in, out. You were allowed to be there, you know, in the streets if you were supporting Sisi. You know, if you had the Sisi paraphernalia with you and everything like that. The people who don't support him, which are now many of the liberals, seculars who started the revolution, the key people of whom have been jailed by this military regime, so they certainly weren't out there, they were in jail, and also the Muslim Brotherhood, they can't be heard because there's now been a law passed that restricts protests and basically gives the police the power to arrest gatherings that they don't like. So, you know, gatherings in favor of Field General Sisi, they are allowed. But when the secularists and liberals gathered, they were fired upon with live ammunition. So, you know, it's difficult to say. And, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood, many of the leaders have been arrested, and those who haven't been arrested are, in effect, under house arrest, or house self-imposed exile, because if they go out and are recognized as Brotherhood members, they can be arrested simply for that reason, because the government has branded the whole organization as a terrorist organization. So it's a really a terrible, terrible picture in Egypt. But I noticed in your summary, the one group you didn't mention, which I really think merits mentioning, and that is the, you know, the people who did originally lead the revolution 3 years ago, and their followers. And, you know, I think it's easy to think that those people have simply disappeared because we don't see them in any positions of power. But I think the film that I discussed in the article, The Square, this Oscar-nominated documentary of all 3 years of the revolution, shows us through the lives of three people who were very active in it, that this movement is still alive. It's very much still alive. But, it, you know, it's going to take a long time for the changes that were the original changes of the revolution, social justice, bread, individual freedoms, rule of law, it's going to take a long time for those to take hold in Egypt. But people are still fighting for them.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Cynthia Snyder, who's a professor of diplomacy at Georgetown University, dean of the School of Diplomacy at Dubrovnik International University, and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. From 1998 to 2001, she served as U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands, during which time she led initiatives in cultural diplomacy, biotechnology, cybersecurity, and education. She has an article at CNN, How America Abandoned Egypt's Arab Spring. So General Sisi is announcing somewhat magnanimously that he wants to unite the people, restore security, and Egypt's international standing. I would think that if the movie The Square wins the Academy Award, it may get some showing around the world. And I know the filmmakers and the film, and it does not increase General Sisi's standing in the world and his government. So what's your sense of whether there can be some pressure from the outside for the general to at least restore some semblance of democracy?
You know, I have to honestly say I'm not as optimistic as I would like to be about that. We are told that Secretary Hagel is on the phone regularly with General Sisi, with when he was still a regular general, with no apparent effect whatsoever, and, you know, the United States has withheld some aid, not all of it, though. We still have a sizable military relationship with Egypt. And meanwhile, other countries, notably Saudi Arabia and the UAE, are coming in with huge donations to Egypt now to sort of keep this government afloat. So I'm in the short term, I'm not optimistic because he simply doesn't seem to respond to pressure. In the long term, I think that he's going to do as well in the presidency as President Morsi is. And by that, I mean that the Egyptian people are simply not going to put up with another authoritarian regime that does not deliver on the basic economic development reforms that are so desperately needed in that country. And in a way, it's impossible for General Sisi to do that because the military controls a sizable proportion. It's kind of a black box. Nobody knows exactly how much, but be, you know, cautious and say 30% of the economy. And so naturally there's interest in the military maintaining positions of power, and now with the new constitution, positions of impunity. They can't be touched by any other branch of government because that enables them to have this financial control and to enrich themselves really without any oversight.
So, Cynthia Snyder, then going back 3 years ago to the revolution, and I've spoken over the period of time with a lot of the people involved in the revolution, which as you point out, was led by the liberal and secular forces initially, and the Islamists sat on the fence and then later joined, and they ended up being the beneficiaries of the runoff and the second election, which the better candidates, both on the Islamist side and on the secular side, didn't make it to the final round. You ended up with the worst of both worlds. But I remember talking to Jawad Nabulsi, who's one of the who organized the first triage first aid outfit for the in the revolution, and he said he'd been talking to during the period of Morsi. He kept talking to the Morsi people and saying, you know, you guys are screwing it up, you're incompetent. What you don't understand is that at the end of the day, they're going to come after both you and us, you know. And he seemed to have predicted it accurately.
Absolutely. And I mean, one thing that you said in your early preamble that I just want to modify slightly, it was indeed the military who pushed Morsi out, but they were only able to do that because of the huge youth-led grassroots popular movement led initially by the Tamarud movement against Morsi. And that's what brought all the people out into the streets. And then the military, I think, in a very smart way, simply consolidated their power. And what's disappointing, and this relates to what was disappointing about the election to which you refer, what's disappointing is that the liberal forces in Egypt still don't seem to be able to organize themselves in any politically effective way. Now, some of them won seats in parliament in the early election, and you know, and that was fantastic. But unfortunately, now one of them, for example, both of them, I think, Amr Hamzawi and Mustafa El-Megar, are both not being allowed to leave the country. But as a single group or a two parties, even there hasn't yet been that sort of political maturation and the tough decision making, you know, that leads you not to run three candidates but to run one candidate. And I think there, you know, there was a moment, certainly you needed the military to actually physically remove Morsi from power. The demonstrators weren't going to be able to do that. But sadly, there was no sort of civilian coalition in waiting to say, okay, so now we have a transition government, and then we will move to elections. And instead, General Sisi moved to consolidate, and he played on, I think, some very real sentiments, and they really were sentiments that had to do with the Egyptian sense of pride and the Egyptian sense of identity. And I think many people I talked to had actually ventured a vote on Morsi, willing to give him a chance, but the Brotherhood presidency was so disappointing because it did nothing to meet the needs of the country. And I think many people just looked at President Morsi and thought, no, this person does not represent me. The Egyptians are a very proud people with good reason. It's a 7,000-year-old civilization. So the contrast between this sort of maladroit, and we all know about the awkward gestures and the poor English, President Morsi, and this very handsome General Sisi in uniform, I think the contrast is so stark that many people have just gone over to General Sisi because they feel he visually, in whatever way, represents Egypt better.
So, Cynthia Schneider, is that to say then that what happened 3 years ago was not a revolution but an uprising? After all, you know, the military have run Egypt since 1952, and now they're back in the saddle, and assuming that Sisi gets ratified in the April elections, they could be there to stay for God knows how long.
And you I don't think so at all. I don't think so at all, and I didn't mean to give that impression. I think what happened absolutely was a revolution. And I think what happened this summer was a revolution again. And what happened, again, this is not perceptible on the political map, but people changed. You know, the Egyptians always say, we have not yet banished the regime, but we have banished fear. And I think that is tremendously important. You know, they talked about the original 18 days as a time when people woke up from their sleep and, you know, woke up to the realization that they had rights and that their government should be responsible to them. Now, the problem is they woke up in a country where there was basically a vacuum. You know, there's very little civil society, very little political organization. So you have two institutions, the Brotherhood and the army. And it's going to take time before the feelings and the awakening that absolutely took place can coalesce into real political candidates and movements. But it absolutely is going to happen, and I think you cannot put the genie back into the bottle. And again, to go back to the film, The Square, I think the last moment of that film where you see the young man Ahmed Hassan, the former lime vendor who has really found his voice in Tahrir Square, 3 years later, after the breakup of the Brotherhood camps this past August, Sisi is in power. It's looking quite bleak, very restrictive. And when he's asked, you know, how do you see the future, he says, now is the time that Egypt must develop a conscience. Well, you know, I think that is just an incredible comment. It's so incredible. I did ask the filmmaker, Jahan Nujam, did he really say that? How is that possible that someone just comes out with something like that? And she assured me that he really did just say that. And I think it's a very profound comment. You know, in a way, we expect this, you know, fully formed political nation to emerge after 18 days. And it's just not possible for people who've been under authoritarian rule for decades. But nor is it possible, I think, for them to go back to authoritarian rule for decades.
Well, just in closing, Cynthia Snyder, if indeed the Liberals sort of got had by supporting Temerud and then ending up with the military and being out in the cold, and then you have to add to that, as you mentioned earlier, the foreign interference, the Saudis, there was a tremendous shortage of gasoline and diesel and food, which was probably artificially manipulated. And the minute the military came back in, suddenly the money flowed out of the Gulf. So their motives, of course, are very anti-democratic. What can the Liberals do to come back?
You know, I was talking to an Egyptian lawyer the other night on the anniversary of the revolution, and he said that actually, despite the drawbacks of the Constitution, which does protect the military and basically insulates it from any form of oversight, but despite that, it does actually guarantee more individual freedoms than previously existed in Egypt. And he suggested that one avenue is for people to take cases through the courts, to protest the treatment they're getting and to take these cases through the courts, which are, you know, I said, do you think the courts are reliable? And he said, on the whole, yes, not always, but on the whole, yes. So that's one path, go through the courts. I have another friend, a very active in civil society, who has been working for years on reform of the security sector, and she's going to continue to do that. So I think you have to chip away at the system to the very best of your ability. And then the other thing is really political maturation. There has to be some kind of a consensus around a candidate for president. And really, you know, good professional campaigning. And I think, you know, I hope very much that will happen. It hasn't happened yet, but I think people realize that in the earlier election, had they had one candidate instead of three, they had the majority of votes.
Right.
So, you know, that may not be possible against General Sisi. He's very popular right now, and he's going to seize the moment. But I don't think he's going to stay there forever. And, you know, just the one other element that you mentioned, it's certainly not a sustainable situation to have the entire Muslim Brotherhood leadership in prison, much less the former president on trial. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood, whether you like them or not, and there's no question that they ruled very, very badly when they had the opportunity to do so, they still have the support of, you know, at least 20-25% of the population. And not only that, but they traditionally, part of that support comes from the fact that they have provided essential social services to the poor of Egypt that the government has not provided. It's a perfect storm.
Well, Ambassador Cynthia Snyder, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Cynthia Snyder, who's a professor of diplomacy at Georgetown University, dean of the School of Diplomacy at Dubrovnik International University, and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. From 1998 to 2001, she served as U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands, during which time she led initiatives in cultural diplomacy, biotechnology, cybersecurity, and education. She has an article at CNN, How America Abandoned Egypt's Arab Spring. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about income and wealth disparity, which President Obama is expected to discuss in his upcoming State of the Union address. شجر الحكاية مواويل طرب ونسام Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sam Pizzicati, who's a veteran labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and an editor at the online newsletter Too Much. His latest book is The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph of a Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class. And he has an article at the Washington Spectator, Plutocrats Ponder in the Alps. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Pizzicati.
Thank you, Ian.
And I'd like to talk to you about your article on the Davos meeting in the Swiss Alps that's just finished, where the plutocrats sit around in hot tubs, sipping champagne, wringing their hands over the fate of the world. But the president is expected to talk about income disparity in his upcoming State of the Union address. What's your sense of how far he's going to take the argument?
Well, all signs are that we're getting from advanced press reports, all signs are that he's not going to take it very far. I think there's a great deal of confusion now in the public mind about inequality. Various politicians are doing their best to water down a discussion about inequality into a discussion about opportunity, and I fear the president is going to play into that confusion tonight.
So opportunity is a slogan, but not a reality.
That's right. And when politicians normally talk about opportunity, many times they're talking about opportunity in a blame the victim sort of way. In other words, people don't have the skills to succeed, and that's why we have a problem with inequality. Well, of course, that's not the case at all. We have a problem with inequality because our 1%, actually our top 0.1%, have rigged the rules in America their way, and essentially have placed a big squeeze on average American workers.
But the president will be speaking to a Republican House and a Democratic Senate. And there's no question that the Republicans have consistently gone to the mat for millionaires and billionaires, particularly on preserving tax cuts. They've threatened to shut down the entire government and tank the economy, all in the name of the terrible sky is falling deficits. But the real agenda is to get tax breaks for the rich. It's been so obvious, and they really do fight the good fight on behalf of the rich. So is it time for Obama to call them out? He hasn't exactly given Wall Street a hard time, but he's certainly not as supine as the House is.
Certainly not. But President Obama, unfortunately, has a problem in his own party, because we have influential figures like Chuck Schumer, the senior senator from New York State, who has been talking about essentially not demonizing the rich and not talking about taxing the wealthy. And talk like this undercuts the president, undercuts his efforts to really make this country a much more equal place.
Well, a plutocrat in the Silicon Valley recently wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal suggesting that the 1% like him were being misunderstood and they were being scapegoated like the Nazis scapegoated the Jew. And he was talking that Kristallnacht is just around the corner for the billionaires. Where does that sort of paranoid fantasy come from?
Well, that you're referring to the venture capitalist from Silicon Valley, Tom Perkins, and he has certainly stirred up a firestorm with his comment that talked about the demonization of the 1% in the same way that he said that Jews were demonized in Nazi Germany during the time of Kristallnacht. Of course, this is outrageous. When we talk about top 1%, that's not a demonization. That's a description of reality, a description of the top-heavy distribution of wealth and income that we have in the United States today. And for figures like Tom Perkins, this very wealthy billionaire venture capitalist, they see the world in a very different way. They see the world as rewarding people for their creativity and their hard work, and that's how they justify their grandstanding in the world. But I think comments like this by Tom Perkins reveal just how out of touch the super rich are. They're a group of people surrounded by people like them, and they live in a totally luxurious bubble.
Again, I'm speaking with Sam Pizzicato, who's a veteran labor journalist, an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and an editor at the online newsletter Too Much. His latest book is The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class, and he has an article at the Washington Spectator, Plutocrats Ponder in the Alps. But the president is delivering his State of the Union only a few days after Oxfam came up with their study Working for the Few, which found that the world's richest 85 people, that's just 85 people on this planet, have the combined wealth equal to that of the bottom half of the world's population of 3.5 billion people. What more evidence does the president want?
That's right. There's a very powerful Oxfam report that came out just before the annual Davos retreat of the world's ultra-rich and powerful. There are a number of incredibly dramatic stats in that report, including a figure on the amount of cash that the wealthy now have stashed in offshore tax havens. Oxfam researchers estimate that stash at $18.5 trillion. In other words, this is almost $19 trillion that every year is generating income that essentially goes tax-free.
Well, isn't our annual GDP $15 trillion?
That's right. So that just gives you a sense of the immense size of this stash of cash now in offshore tax havens.
Well, also, a lot of big American corporations just park their profits offshore and don't pay taxes.
There are all sorts of very esoteric tax loopholes that companies like Amazon and Google and Apple use to hide and park their profits. I would like to see the president tonight in the State of the Union address go after these loopholes, no holds barred. But unfortunately, I don't expect that to happen.
So tell me, Sam Pizzicato, about your book, The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class. Given that the president is supposed to address this issue, which I think is out there in the political zeitgeist, I think people feel it, they know it, and it's probably a good opportunity for a teachable moment. So what can you teach Obama from the book that you wrote?
Well, I think what the rich don't always win, what this new book can teach is a very positive lesson. And that is, just over a century ago in the early 1900s in the United States, we faced a rich and powerful, a plutocracy that was even more rich and powerful than our top 1% is today. Yet over the span of the next half century, we trimmed that super rich down to democratic size. The United States in the middle of the 20th century was a much, much more equal place than the United States in the early 1900s. We went from America, an America that was two-thirds poor, poor to an America that was two-thirds middle class. We went from a top 1% that was annually getting almost a quarter of the nation's income to a top 1% that was getting less than 8% of the nation's annual income. So we made a real difference over the first half of the 20th century. And if we made that difference back then, why can't we do that again? Why can't we launch another offensive against inequality that'll make this country safe for average working people?
Well, Sam Pizzagatti, arguably we were a social democracy that had a vibrant middle class from 1947 to 1977. And with the coming of Ronald Reagan, all of those gains that you just mentioned were rolled back. And it took a while from the beginning of the century with McKinley, followed, of course, by the accidental presidency of Teddy Roosevelt and the Depression, etc., to bring about equity in the United States. But one of the things I find fascinating about the period that you just referred to, the original Gilded Age of McKinley, during that great political contest between William Jennings Bryan and the plutocrat McKinley, the political left, there was such a thing as a religious left back in those days, where urban and rural poor that were religious and evangelical voted for their class interests. They didn't vote against their class interests like the modern-day televangelists encourage their followers in the red states to do.
Well, that's true. There's a very strong progressive religious strain in Protestant circles. There was a movement that was called the Social Gospel movement that was very strong. In Catholic circles, you had Father John Ryan from Minnesota, who was originally from Minnesota, who was a strong leader and a strong advocate of a more equal distribution of income and wealth in the United States. So you had powerful religious movements going on at those towns at that time, which supplemented the political efforts and created a cultural environment of struggle against inequality.
Well, obviously, the canard that's been floated every time anybody talks about income disparity and wealth disparity is, you know, the specter of class war is raised. And to my mind, it's an absurdity. I mean, if there's a class war, then we're all POWs. We've lost. I mean, if 85 people control half of the world's wealth, I'd say the war's over, wouldn't you?
Well, Warren Buffett, the billionaire in investor, has a quip that's become rather famous. He says, we're having a class war. We've had a class war in this country, and my side won. And I think that's what you're getting at. And you can look at the situation and certainly say that's the case. But class wars are never over. And our class, the class of average people, class of working people in the United States, we're certainly down at this point. We've been hammered hard over the past 30 to 40 years, but we can come back. And just as the people came before us came back against America's original plutocracy.
Well, in your article in the Washington Spectator, Sam Pizzagatti, "Plutocrats Ponder in the Alps," you talk about this idea that the world's wealthiest people talk about these issues, but obviously not in a way that we are discussing them. What's your understanding, though, about Obama in this context? Because I know, for example, that Bill Clinton seemed to be really comfortable with plutocrats, and he seemed to be able to really charm them and get huge lecture fees. Maybe Obama will do that when he gets out of office, but I'm not entirely convinced that he's that thrilled with them, or maybe I'm wrong.
Well, that's an interesting point, and I can't go into his mind and sort of scope out what his true feelings are. What we do know from historical figures like Franklin Roosevelt, for instance, Franklin Roosevelt was born rich and circulated among rich people all his life, and what that left Franklin Roosevelt with was an understanding that rich people are no smarter or dumber than anybody else. He was distinctly unimpressed by the rich. Sometimes people not born into wealth can be terribly impressed by wealth and intimidated by it. FDR certainly wasn't. I don't know where President Obama is on that score.
Well, we do know that FDR took the fight to them, didn't he? I mean, they were scurrilous and scandalous, not unlike the way the Republicans have been about Obama, where they've tried to delegitimize him by simply suggesting that he's not even an American citizen. He wasn't even born here. Therefore, you don't have to deal with him. And you had one Republican Congressman, Jeff Sessions from Texas, saying, to Obama's face, I can't stand to look at you. So they've taken the fight to Obama. But unlike FDR, who said, I welcome their hatred, Obama has not. Do you think something will change tonight?
No. I don't expect to see any big change tonight. Obama's getting pressured by many of his advisors, like Senator Chuck Schumer from New York, to lay off the inequality talk, to lay off the talk about combating the over-influence of the 1% in American society. So we'll see what course he chooses.
Well, but, you know, we all know that it is a kabuki theater that's going on in Washington, that both parties are owned by the same moneyed interests. I mean, that's what's really going on here, isn't it?
That's right. But there is a very strong tension within the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party gets its votes from one group of people and gets its money from another. It gets its money from deep pockets in the United States, just as the Republican Party does. So there is this inherent tension within the Democratic Party, and at different times, different sides of this equation are on the ascendancy. And I think now is a period where things are up for grabs in the party. There's a lot of grassroots pressure on the president now to take on inequality in a serious way, and that pressure needs to increase if we're going to really make a move against inequality.
Well, Sam Pizzicati, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sam Pizzicati, who's a veteran labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and an editor at the online newsletter Too Much. His latest book is The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class. And he has an article at the Washington Spectator, Plutocrats Ponder in the Alps. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about dog whistle politics on the right. You never give me your money. You only give me your funny paper. And in the middle of negotiations, you break down. I never give you my number. You've been born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train. But it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in our game. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his path-breaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. His latest book, just out, is Dog Whistle Politics: How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Haney-Lopez.
Thanks very much. Glad to join you.
And in about 15 or 20 minutes or so, the president will be speaking at his State of the Union, but he'll be speaking to a House that's divided, given that half of the room appear to have made a career out of demonizing Obama in ways that are both racist and disrespectful to the office of the presidency. Do you think he should call them out on dog whistle politics?
Well, first of all, I think we should understand how race is being used against him. the public discourse of racism has really shifted in the last 50 years, and it now occurs in code. So that on one level, it doesn't seem to be about race at all. Maybe it's about Muslims or about illegal aliens or about whether President Obama is foreign-born or what his policies are on welfare. And on the other, it's really triggering racial fears, terrorists, foreign-born, Muslim, welfare. All of those are ways to trigger anxiety about what's happening in America and whether minorities are this threatening presence. Now, given that rhetorical evolution, watch what happens. If President Obama were to say, hey, race is being used to scare the American public, to divide you, to make you afraid of me, he would immediately be attacked, and the attack would take this form. First, conservatives would say, what do you mean race? We never said race. We just said Muslim, foreign-born, liar, cheater, and lazy, right? But we never said race. And then they would say, but someone did say race. You did, President Obama. You're the first person to put race into this conversation. You're dividing us by race. You're playing the race card, and you're the real racial bigot. Now, that is just a stock rhetorical routine within conservative racial discourse now. And what's the upshot? The upshot is we get a constant litany of racial innuendo, and at the same time, it's very hard to address it head on because the minute you say, hey, this is race baiting, you get accused of being a racist. So should Obama call out his critics for race baiting? I don't think he can afford to. I think it's just too dangerous for him to do that right now.
So, in other words, his tormentors in the Congress who use race to unite and motivate their dwindling base, there is no way to point that out, even though endless amounts of political scientists have pointed it out.
There's no way for President Obama to point it out, but it's incumbent on members of his administration, on civil rights groups, on foundations, on liberals generally, on the public, you know, as a whole, to really begin to protest this sort of politics. And in this sense, there's something critically important that the Obama administration can do. The Obama administration has been aggressive in telling its allies in unions and foundations and civil rights groups not to talk about race because they don't want the Obama administration embroiled in racial disputes. I think that's a terrible blunder. I don't think Obama ought to address dog whistle politics, but I think he ought to give the green light to others who are close to him to begin to talk about what a destructive force this is in American life, and that's something the administration could and should do.
So given that Congressman Sessions of Texas, apparently at a White House meeting, said to the president, I can't even stand to look at you, and it obviously was behind the scenes it was agreed that that people would sort of forget about it. The president must have had to swallow that one. What is it in this man that gives him this ability to turn the other cheek?
I think temperamentally, President Obama learned the wrong lesson in his life. Temperamentally, he learned the lesson that if you stay above the fray, that you can bring everybody together and that rational discourse alone will lead to a consensus that will allow us all to move forward. That makes sense unless there are huge vested issues at stake. And we have to realize that sort of vision of American politics is completely at odds with what's happened. Over the last 50 years, power over American government has shifted from the people to the corporations to the wealthiest individuals. And in this context, they have a tremendous amount to lose by cooperating with a Democratic administration that wants to use government to start taking care of the middle class again. This isn't going to be about communication. This isn't going to be about consensus building. At the end of the day, this is about power. This is about who controls government and whether government is stacked to favor the very rich or to take care of the rest of us. And that's not going to be something that comes through negotiation. Obama needs to realize that he needs to mobilize his base. He needs to help get liberals elected. He needs to use his bully pulpit to mobilize the electorate. That's the sort of speech that he ought to be engaged in, not this sort of turn the other cheek, compromise, look for consensus with people who are never going to cooperate with him.
Again, I'm speaking with Ian Haney Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his path-breaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. His latest book just out is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. So he's apparently is going to talk about the growing wealth and income disparity in the United States. And I take it that you feel that there's a direct connection there between the plutocratic power of, the fact that we arguably are no longer a democracy but have become a plutocracy and our economy is a plutonomy. How do dog whistle politics feed and propagate the disparity?
I think there's a very direct connection. We are experiencing levels of wealth inequality that we haven't seen in 100 years. Well, what happened 100 years ago? You had robber barons, you had concentrated wealth, you had a financial collapse, you had the Great Depression. But in the wake of the Great Depression, we realize that we need that government must organize the economy, government must organize society, and the question is, for whom should it be organized? And we decided that government and the economy should be organized to take care of the middle class, and we understood what was required: routes of upward mobility, a social safety net, investment in infrastructure, and progressive taxation to take money from the very wealthiest in society, to prevent concentrations of wealth, and to distribute it broadly. That was a consensus under which Democrats and Republicans alike governed this country through the 1960s. But with the civil rights movement and with change in terms of racial dynamics, conservatives came to understand that while they could not win by directly attacking New Deal liberalism, they could win if they presented their attacks on New Deal liberalism as instead a repudiation of lazy minorities. And here's the significance of terms like welfare queen that Ronald Reagan used. Ronald Reagan told the story of a welfare queen tooling around in a Cadillac to say to white voters, lazy minorities are ripping you off. They're taking the government's money, which is ultimately your money. We ought to slash the social safety net, yes, but we also ought to cut taxes. And so you get this tax revolution in which whites think that they're cutting taxes to cut off these lazy minorities. But in fact, under the Reagan administration in the 1980s, over $1 trillion in went through these tax cuts to the richest 1% of Americans. And then a further $1 trillion has gone to the richest 1% of Americans because of the Reagan tax cuts every decade thereafter. So if you want to understand what has happened to the country, why the rich are so insanely wealthy now, and why the rest of us are struggling with jobs, are struggling with a housing crisis, are struggling with a government that doesn't seem to take care of us, and doesn't seem to invest in infrastructure, the answer is look at the way cultural provocations, and in particular race, have been used to convince a broad segment of the middle class that their real enemy is minorities, when in fact the real enemy is concentrated wealth and the way it's trying to hijack government.
So do you think the president therefore made a mistake when he first came into office agreeing not to point out how much of the treasury was buried into a rat hole in the sands of Iraq and the lives were wasted? And then on top of that, I think, you know, we're talking about maybe $7 trillion have been spent since 9/11 with very little to show for it except disastrous wars. And then on top of that, something like $12 trillion was spent to bail out Wall Street. And you would think that a narrative that could cut across what you're telling us, Ian Haney Lopez, is one that points out how much the working Americans, whether they're black, white, or Latino, have in common.
I think that's exactly right. I think President Obama blundered terribly at the start of his administration. He campaigned on the promise of change, and what you saw is that the American public is hungry for change, hungry for a new, not just for bringing government back onto the side of the middle class, but for a new understanding of what has happened to us over the last 50 years. And I think Obama was in a perfect position because of the different calamities confronting the country in 2008, beginning in 2009. He was in the perfect position to say to the American public, we need to stop being divided by race. We need to stop all this nonsense about minorities being the big threat in our lives. We need to realize the way in which concentrated wealth has hijacked government. We need to bring government back onto the side of the middle class. And if people are going to holler and protest and whine about how this is class warfare, you bet, because we've been in a class warfare for the last 50 years and we've been losing. That was the perfect opportunity to do that. But instead, even in his inaugural address, he pivoted and began to reach out across the aisle, seeking this bipartisan consensus. And in order to do that, he began to use Republican frames. He began to talk about the way in which a bloated federal government was the problem, about how we ought to freeze wages for federal employees, about how taxes were too high. And the minute he seized on the Republican frame, he spelled doom for his own administration, because the Republican frame is fundamentally one that says the problem is that government is run by and for minorities. And now here we have a black president who seems to confirm the very validity of that crazy thesis. So, yes, I think that by the time you get the Tea Party, by the time you get the 2010 elections, yes, it's true. President Obama's hands were tied by Republican intransigence in Washington. But in January of 2009, that history, that future was yet unwritten, and he had a tremendous opportunity to use the crises that have been falling the country to give us a new narrative about what happened, who was to blame, and how we could move forward.
And, of course, when the crash happened and the bailout happened and TARP happened, curiously enough, it was the Democrats who abdicated that issue, and it was picked up. The outrage over Wall Street's bailout was picked up by the Tea Party, of all people, who ended up being shills for the plutocrats. So therein is the tragedy of leaving that whole narrative off the table. But given that where we stand today and the president's future hangs in the balance here in this election year of 2014, and the polls don't indicate particularly optimistic picture that the Democrats could lose the Senate and continue to lose or even lose the House by more, and that would make him a lame duck. So at what point will he have skin in the game? Rather than be an early lame duck, why not come out fighting this year and try and get the turnout? Because the turnout's what it's all about. You know, in 2010, only 75 million voted after 145 million had voted a couple of years earlier to sweep the Democrats in.
I completely agree. I think that there remains an opportunity for President Obama to provide a new narrative about what has happened to the country and why. And I'm really glad you mentioned the Tea Party. We should be very clear. Tea Partiers, they hate President Obama. But this is not to say they're bad people. This is not to say they're racist. We need to be absolutely clear. Tea Partiers are Americans who are hurting. At the grassroots level, these are people who are seeing jobs go away, who are seeing retirement pensions go away, who are worried about the future, their own future. They're worried about their children, and they really want to understand what happened to the America in which if you worked hard and played by the rules, you got ahead and you could be assured of a better future for your children. These are the people that Obama ought to be talking to, and what he ought to be telling them is, you won't find a solution in all of this panic about minorities. You won't find new jobs. You won't find investment in infrastructure. You won't find a social safety net in all this hysteria about minorities. You need instead to think about the way in which our government has been taken over and been hijacked. But I think it's very important for all of us to understand there's a real hunger in the United States, in the population as a whole, to understand what happened to us. And this story about how the country is being destroyed by minorities, a lot of people understand it's just bunk. They don't accept it, but they need to be offered something else, and it's up to President Obama to begin telling that story, and also and up to the rest of us, I'd say.
Well, I think, Ian Haney-Lopez, what's happening now with Obamacare and has happened with the Affordable Care Act since it started, it's been, under attack remorselessly by the Republicans. And again, the dog whistle-coded racial appeals in the opposition to Obamacare is that essentially your premiums are going to go up just to take a bunch of freeloaders off the streets and give them free health care. And is there any chance that can be turned around in time before October? Is there any chance that the evidence that, in other words, are all boats going to rise with Obamacare?
I think that there is a chance. I don't think it's a, I don't think this is about Obamacare in particular. I think this is about whether government is fundamentally on the side of the American people or is fundamentally a threat to them because it's been hijacked by minorities. Those are the two stories that are out there. And now, crazy as it may seem, a majority of whites seem to subscribe to the idea that government's the biggest threat in their lives because it's been hijacked by minorities. I think it's incredibly important for people to get out and say government is necessary, government for the middle class, government concerned with the fate of all of us, government investing in the country and protecting people from the predations of great wealth is incredibly important to all of us. And if what's getting in the way of good government is all of this rhetoric of racial division, we need to say no more. We refuse to be bamboozled by these claims that government is just giving away the store to minorities. We understand that government needs to work for everybody. That's the story that President Obama needs to tell. Can he tell that story in a coherent, convincing way, in a way that reaches everybody by October of this year? Maybe, maybe not. But he has to start, because in starting, he'll lay the groundwork for other politicians at the presidential level, but also at the state level, to tell the same story and to begin to weave this new narrative. And I should say, I say new narrative, this is really an old narrative. This is the old New Deal narrative with this difference. The New Deal had a critical flaw built into it, in the sense that the New Deal, because it required the cooperation of the Southern Democrats, was racially restrictive. This is the old New Deal, FDR, Second Bill of Rights narrative, but now unencumbered by racial divisions.
But, of course, the difference was that FDR, when he was attacked in this poisonous way that Obama is being attacked, and largely by the plutocrats, he said, I welcome their hatred. He really took them on. Is it because Obama is a black man, he doesn't want to come across as an angry black man?
I think that Obama's blackness increases the risk of him being understood as inappropriately angry, as dangerously angry. I definitely think that there's that element. But I don't think that's the bulk of it. I think the bulk of it is temperamental. I think President Obama fundamentally misunderstands or has misunderstood the situation, has misunderstood the way in which the interests of the very rich are ranged against us. But I do think that he needs to look at FDR for a model. We will not change our narrative. We will not change our politics simply through a positive message of we're all in this together, let's pull together and work together. Mm-hmm. We need a sense of who's to blame, who's been doing this, and who's been getting rich while we've been getting poor. That's where FDR understood. People had to have a sense that there were people out there who didn't have their best interests at heart, who were bad for the public generally. Mm-hmm. And I think FDR was right to welcome their animosity, and we'll need that sort of politics again.
Well, Ian Hanley-Lopez, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciated the conversation.
Again, I've been speaking with Ian Hanley-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley. He is an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his path-breaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. His latest book just out is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at IanMasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.